You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up at 4:30, a look at Governor Walker's call for lower tuition in UW system schools.
First, have you ever wondered about things like, why do our stomachs sometimes rumble? And how do our hearts know to beat? Is coffee good or bad for you? What about vitamins? These are some of the offbeat questions many of us wish we could find simple answers to.
We have operating instructions for everything from our cars to our TV sets, so why not a manual for operating the human body? Our next guest decided to take a stab at exactly that. James Hamblin is a doctor. He just wrote a guide to owning and operating the human body. He's in the studio with us to answer your questions about how we work, everything you ever wanted to know but were afraid to ask. Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Not medical advice, by the way. Just those curious questions. You can also post your question on the Central Time Facebook page.
James Hamblin is a doctor and a senior editor at The Atlantic Magazine. His new book is called If Our Bodies Could Talk, A Guide to Operating and Maintaining a Human Body. Dr. Hamblin, welcome to Central Time.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me.
Well, why did you think that we needed a book like this?
Well, these questions are out there, and I write for a magazine, and also went to medical school, so I end up hearing a lot of them from friends and family and from readers. So I decided if I put them all in one place, then I could just refer people to that, and we wouldn't have to constantly be addressing them.
And when you started coming out with this idea, did you have people coming out of the woodwork? They're like, oh, interesting idea. Oh, and by the way, dot, dot, dot.
Yes, I started getting even more questions than normal. So I couldn't take them all on here. And this, the premise of the book is a little bit of exaggeration. I make the point in the book that a lot of these things don't have simple answers. Mm-hmm. And I sort of tell stories that explain why we don't know and how it can sometimes be comforting to exist in this space of not knowing everything. And that's okay.
Do you think that sometimes people are, I don't know, a little embarrassed not to know this really basic stuff, like about whether or not everyone drools or why our stomachs rumble?
Yeah. And that was part of the idea, too, is it, maybe it's just me, but in my imagination, a lot of people would enjoy reading a textbook of anatomy and physiology if it was more fun to read, if it was told through stories and through things that we actually wonder and care about. So I sort of reverse engineered a textbook in that way.
And one question that struck me, one I think about a lot, one of the first ones in the book, how do I know if I'm beautiful?
Rob, you're always wondering that about yourself.
Yeah, tossing my hair.
Right. So I wanted to establish at the top sort of standards of the premise of a lot of questions is it normal that, or, uh-huh. You know, an example of beauty that seems to be sort of arbitrary is dimples, which I get into in the book. There's a trend, small trend in dimple surgeries where people
really
are having dimples put into their faces. A relatively quick lunchtime procedure, but not without risks. And there's a period of time where the dimples don't go away. While you're recovering, you have 24/7 dimples, not just while you're smiling. But anyway, I think there's a world out there where people are ashamed of their dimples or have dimple surgeries to try to get rid of their dimples. So a lot of this is kind of arbitrary.
So I have a chin dimple. Do people want those, or is it just the cute cheek ones?
I think you should, if you have it, you should be really happy with it. And if you don't have it, then you should consider them not worth envying. It's one of those things that reminds us that these standards are pretty arbitrary because they don't serve a functional purpose in making us longer lived or better at chewing.
Talking to Dr. James Hamblin, his new book is If Our Bodies Could Talk, A Guide to Operating and Maintaining a Human Body. He answers a lot of those puzzling, curious questions about how we work. Well, one of those we kind of tease this with is, does everybody drool? I assume so. I've been there. Is that a fact of being human?
Yeah. Again, not something that I learned in medical school, but if you... a lot of people do notice that when they take a nap, they will have drooled, but they don't, when they sleep through the night, don't think that they've drooled. And the idea is that because when you're first falling asleep, you're more likely to drool. You just notice it if you wake up earlier, but you would have done it when you were falling asleep for the night as well.
So the drool has dried is basically what you're telling us.
Yeah, if you're a drooler when you nap, you're a drooler when you sleep.
Well, here's what I want to know about. We talked about this a bit on the show, but we're interested to get your take. What about probiotics? Do they work and should we all be taking them?
Yeah. This is something that we are going to be hearing about over and over again in coming years. And probiotics is a very broad term. You know, we've just recently really come to appreciate that the trillions of microbes that live inside our guts and shape our lives in so many different ways. And so it's very logical to want to optimize those populations. But it turns out there's great variation in the populations between you and the person next to you and what those microbes are like. And the dynamics between so many different entities and what makes a population healthy, we're barely scratching the surface of beginning to understand that, much less to be able to modulate it by throwing in one type of bacterium and assuming that's going to be good for everyone in all conditions. So it's kind of arbitrary right now.
Yeah, this seems like one of those cutting edge things in the world of science where we're realizing that in our guts and elsewhere, there's this ecosystem as complicated as any swamp or jungle.
Yes, exactly. A metaphor that I like is the idea of just going out into the forest with a bag of seeds, and it says, you know, assorted seeds, and assuming that if you take a handful and throw it into the forest, you will be doing good for the ecosystem, or that anything would take at all, and then if it did, that it wouldn't be, you know, that would be beneficial.
I think I might be merging a couple of your sections together, but I think you get at fiber and the role that that has in the gut biome.
Yeah. So we're getting the sense of how expansive this book is, but if there is one thing that we know to generally increase diversity and favorable ecosystems in the gut, it's a high fiber plant-based diet. People who eat diets that are high in animal products, meat and cheeses, tend to have less gut diversity and more populations of unfavorable bacteria, as far as we know. It's kind of the interesting thing is it's reinforcing this age-old wisdom of eat your fruits and vegetables. We're just now understanding a mechanism as to why that, another way that might be associated with long life and good health.
A related topic that I don't think I knew was related involves the way we greet each other. We might hug. We might kiss. I don't kiss, you know, most people anyway. But a lot of us will shake hands.
Yeah.
Apparently, our microbiomes get in the game when we do that.
Yeah.
Huh.
Yeah, they do. We trade a lot of microbes just by being social creatures. And to some degree, that's good. We also know that that is how contagions, cold and flu season, those things are spread that way. So, especially in hospitals, and I've been an advocate of this to do a fist bump, especially during cold and flu seasons, as a sign of respect for someone. We're still understanding how it is that we transmit good population and benefit from being social while not transmitting these pathogens that end up incapacitating us.
And I'm going to ask this next question on behalf of Rob, who has a bit of a stomach rumble. I'm sure all of our listeners are familiar with it. So
hey.
Does everyone have a stomach rumble? Why does it happen?
Yeah. So it has to do with your stomach is constantly sort of like a snake swallowing a rodent. It's contracting and squeezing so that it can move food through from one end to the next. So when there's air inside of that, to various degrees, depending on how much we all tend to swallow air and how often our gastric and colonic muscles contract, you'll hear more or less squeezing in some people, and there's not a lot you can do about it. But it doesn't mean it's not bad.
Or is it? It could be bad, though, right?
Well, it could be bad socially if you find it embarrassing. But again, this is one of those things that if we choose to find it embarrassing, then it's bad. But we don't have to choose.
So if there's like a colleague who draws attention to it, that's when it becomes a problem, is what I'm hearing.
Yes.
I think it's very melodic.
Totally hypothetically.
I consider it the third voice of the show. It's lovely. We're talking right now about how weird and wonderful the human body is with Dr. James Hamblin, senior editor at The Atlantic Magazine. His new book is called If Our Bodies Could Talk, a guide to operating and maintaining a human body.
And you can join in with your burning question about the quirks of the human body at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You've heard some of the kinds of questions we've been tackling. You probably have that nagging thing that you've been thinking about, maybe embarrassed to ask, or you just didn't know who to ask. Well, Dr. Hamlin might be the person. If he doesn't have an answer, it could appear in the sequel. We are talking about how quirky and sometimes befuddling our human bodies are, and this is your chance to ask that question you've always wanted to ask, but maybe not known who to ask, at 800-642-1234. Do you worry about how much sleep is enough? Whether wearing tight pants will give you varicose veins? Why breath smells bad in the morning? Is there something you're curious about in the way we work? Not looking for medical questions here, those curiosity-type questions. Call 800-642-1234. You can also tweet us at Central Time WPR.
James Hamlin stays with us. He's a doctor and senior editor at The Atlantic Magazine. His new book is called If Our Bodies Could Talk, A Guide to Operating and Maintaining a Human Body.
And we'll go to our callers. Chris is on the line in Sparta. Chris, hi.
Hi, I have a curiosity that I would love to hear an answer to, and that is, are eye boogers really microscopic worm poop?
So eye boogers, the stuff that collects, you know, kind of in the corner of our eye there, is it microscopic worm poop is the question on the table, Dr. Hamlin.
Is that really a misconception? I haven't heard it before.
Have you heard this, Chris?
I had heard it, so I keep telling my kid that. And I don't know if I'm lying.
No, it's not. It's a mixture of tears and the oils that are all over our faces, and they just accumulate there when our eyes aren't constantly blinking to wash things away while we are asleep. I mean, but you know, I need to caveat everything that this is the best that we know as yet, and anything is theoretically possible.
And Chris, I hope you're not using this as some sort of behavioral technique. Like, if you misbehave in this way, the eye worms will come back.
Oh, no.
Okay, good. Just wanted to be clear on that.
Scary.
All right, Chris, thanks a lot. Alan, we're going to go next to Becky in Verona. Becky, hi.
Hi. I know we've been hearing a lot about how good the good bacteria is in our guts. And I wondered, when you have a colonoscopy and you have to drink all of that gunk that cleans everything out, does that get rid of the good bacteria and do you have to start over again?
Uh-huh. Thanks, Becky.
I know that's a great question. And I think there will be studies on exactly how that affects everything in the future, since, you know, a lot of this is still relatively new to our understanding. But it certainly doesn't clear out everything. It clears out all the macroscopic material that's in there, but it doesn't eliminate all of the bacteria. It might have some effects, but we also know that colonoscopies are one of the clearly proven ways to prevent cancers from becoming deadly. So no recommendations to be worried about the colonoscopy preparations at the moment.
Becky, thanks for that call. We heard from Paul on email. Paul writes, coffee's going to kill us. No wait, it extends our life. Lipitor should be in the water supply. No wait, it can cause severe cramping and cognitive problems. What's the approach, Paul asks, to dealing with these changing perspectives and fads in popular culture and sometimes also in the medical culture?
That is the perfect question, I think. That's sort of the idea behind the book. It does seem like we are constantly hearing new things, and part of that is, you know, we in the media are responsible for that. You know, what makes a good story? The idea that you're learning something that's totally upending what we knew before. And in fact, as a journalist, that sort of story comes along only probably a few times in your career when you really think that something is completely changing before your eyes. So it's about taking everything in context of what you already knew. Each new study, each new piece of data that you learn about is part of this ongoing evolving blob of scientific knowledge that you're adding to, and it sort of slowly swerves around, but it doesn't make these radical left-hand turns every day.
A swirling blob of knowledge.
Yes, yes.
This is Central Time. Blob of knowledge. A swirling blob of knowledge.
A good book title it would have been. Yeah.
All right, thanks for that question. We'll go next to Deborah in Brown Deer. Deborah, hi.
Hello. I have osteoarthrosis. That's what it said on the diagnosis. In both hips. I have a really bad right hip. And I swear I can predict the weather. So I'm curious if there's any not scientific, like, findings that your body hurts more when it's going to rain or when the barometric pressure is up.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah, yeah. That's something I can't explain is outside of my expertise, but it's such a common observation that I would really be surprised if there were no foundation for it.
Right. I mean, people have their trick knee or trick ankle. I have my trick sinuses that tell me when a pressure front is coming in. Yeah, that is one I've always wondered about and never known if it was true.
Yeah, yeah. I have to say that I've heard it so much anecdotally that I'd be surprised if there were no data on it. That said, this is the kind of research that gets, when research funding is limited, gets kind of pushed to the back burner.
Thanks a lot for that call, Deborah. We'll go next to Brett on the line in Janesville. Brett, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What did you want to ask about, Brett?
When you pop joints like your knuckles or knees or back, what's actually popping? I've heard it could be things like buildup of diffused nitrogen or the bones actually popping in or out of joint.
Yeah, it shouldn't be the bones actually popping in or out of the joint. If you're actually, I mean, it could be if you're actually dislocating your finger, you'd know it. So yeah, it seems to be that it's small bubbles that are making a popping noise when you do it. And I have seen small, sort of inconclusive studies that doing it with great frequency could contribute to earlier degeneration of those joints. But I haven't heard anybody seriously worry about people doing it.
Man, oh man, what do I want to do right now? I don't do that frequently.
No,
I do crack my knuckles.
Just don't do it 24/7. Just like anything, that tends to be the advice.
Moderation.
All right, Brett, thank you for that call. And we go next to Nathan as we talk to Dr. James Hamblin right now. He's the author of the book, If Our Bodies Could Talk, A Guide to Operating and Maintaining a Human Body. You can call us at 800-642-1234. Nathan's next in Walworth. Nathan, hi.
Hi. I was just wondering, why do we get hiccups and how do I get rid of them?
Yeah, some of them are not really fun. Sometimes I feel like there's some mild hiccups and then hiccups extreme, which are just really unpleasant.
Yeah. They're great for radio.
Yeah.
Oh, that must be debilitating. Yeah, there are people who have serious disorders where the hiccups make life almost unlivable. So, yeah, also something that I think is outside of anything that I touch on in the book, because I kind of limited it to questions where I could see a clinical or worldly reason to that this might affect our health. And so the nice thing is that there shouldn't be, unless you have these intractable hiccups where you can't sleep or can't, say, do your job on the radio, that there shouldn't be anything to worry about. And they're nothing more than a curiosity, but one of the many.
Nathan, thanks for the call. Okay, I think we're gonna go here. I can go here, right?
Why don't you go there?
Okay,
this
Gregory.
Is your area.
This is my, Gregory on Twitter writes, where do farts go when you hold them in, parentheses, asking for a friend?
Ah. Well, they certainly don't go anywhere except into the colon. If there's air in there, it'll have to come out eventually. Mm-hmm. But it might wait until the next time you, are in the restroom. Having a bowel movement.
So they don't just magically dissipate or disappear. Gregory.
Right. They might sort of move back through the colon, and the urge might pass, but eventually that air will come out.
Rob, you ask, we seek answers.
Is there anything else you want to ask in that vein, Rob? I know this is your big moment.
There's a running joke, little pranks I play on my colleagues here of changing our scripts to include that particular effort.
Yes. Well,
that's the behind-the-scenes moment in Rob's maturity here at Central Time.
Well, kind of in a not quite the same vein, but I want to ask about tight pants, otherwise known as skinny jeans. Are they bad for us, or are they just maybe a fashion faux pas for some people?
Yeah, I write about that in the book. There was this big story about a woman in Australia about a year and a half ago that sort of went everywhere, all over the news, that she had to have emergency hospitalization because she lost feeling in her feet after wearing tight pants and had to be hospitalized and it ultimately recovered. But the takeaway was, maybe they're dangerous, and that's not a serious concern. And if anything, actually, there's a history of therapeutic uses of tight pants in trauma victims, where you bring a patient into the emergency room who's had trauma, and compression pants are actually applied to stop bleeding. So there's many sides to that story.
Interesting. Well, tight pants, not a big story in my life. But getting back to Rob-related questions, I've got a large-ish Adam's apple, and you write about, this is something people have asked you, why do men have these Adam's apples? Women, not so much.
Right, right. And it is just this, a structure of the cartilage of the larynx, which we all have, and inside that are vocal cords. So during puberty, the cartilage of males tends to grow more, grow outwards, and we get these longer, thicker vocal cords when voices tend to drop, just like the bass notes on a guitar tend to be deeper at that point. But we all have that structure. It's just this spectrum of size.
And a practical one as we get ready to wrap up. So deodorant, you're traveling, you don't have deodorant, but you do have hand sanitizer. Is that going to do the trick?
You must have read that in the book. That isn't something that most people have tried in my experience, but I have.
Right. I have not tried this.
So the active ingredient in most deodorants is an antibacterial. And so, yeah, we're constantly changing that underarm ecosystem and trying to shift it away from the odor-producing bacteria and killing them off every single day. So the ones that the bacterial antibacterials that are in hand sanitizer do kill those bacteria, but it, in my experience, the effect tends to not last as long as a formulated thing that's meant to be a deodorant for a period of more than an hour or so.
Well, Dr. Hamlin, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
That was Dr. James Hamlin, senior editor at The Atlantic Magazine, and we're talking about his new book. It's called If Our Bodies Could Talk, A Guide to Operating and Maintaining a Human Body. If you want to hear more, you can catch James Hamlin tonight at 7 o'clock at the Madison Public Library Central Branch. His talk is free and open to the public.
In last week's State of the State Address, Governor Walker made news with a promise on higher education.
College affordability was also a major issue at our listening sessions. But it wasn't just students who raised it as a concern, as they're concerned about the cost of higher education. It was parents, grandparents, educators, and many others. That's why I'm pleased to announce that our 2017 through 2019 state budget will do more than just freeze tuition. We will actually cut, that's right, cut tuition for all Wisconsin undergraduates throughout the UW system.
If that plan is ultimately approved in the budget process, it would mark the first cut to UW in-state tuition since the early 1980s.
Karen Herzog joins us now. She's a higher education reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Karen, welcome back.
Thanks, Veronica.
Well, Karen, other than what we just heard there from the governor's State of the State address, what do we know about this plan to cut tuition at the UW for undergraduates?
Well, it's one thing that was mentioned on the idea of college affordability. Of course, the governor, tuition cuts go over very well with voters. Everybody likes the idea of tuition cuts. So, of course, the governor would like to see that happen, but it's a lot more complicated than that when you're talking about college affordability. If you cut 1%, I think the Legislative Fiscal Bureau suggested that that might be maybe $100, less than $100 per family for a tuition cut. But at the same time, it would create a $7 to $8 million hole in the UW system's budget that would have to be replaced by the state in order for them not to fall behind. So you create a hole in the budget. You don't give UW system any additional funds to do anything that speeds the time to graduation, and it's a minimal savings for families.
And has the governor said that he would both support making those cuts and also filling the gap that resulted?
Yes, he has. He said that any cut that was made, and of course he it was just one line in his speech, so we have no idea what he's thinking in terms of how much he would like to see cut. But he did say that anything that was cut would be made up for in state funding. So whatever the UW system lost in tuition dollars, they would get back from the state. He's additionally said that UW system, he'd like to see UW system get more funding. On top of that, it would be based on performance measures that haven't been very specifically laid out, but would be things like graduation rates, that kind of thing.
And the UW system has asked for a $42.5 million budget increase. So does all this mean that they're likely to get that full amount?
Oh, boy, if you knew the answer or I knew the answer, we'd really be in a great position to forecast things. But the $42.5 million, in a way, is also targeted at improving college affordability. The UW system has asked for several things. The $42.5 million would, like, boost opportunities for high school students to earn college credits so that by the time they get to the college, they have a head start. Beefing up advising so that students can get through more quickly in the sense that they don't make mistakes, sign up for courses they don't need, they figure out their major earlier, and they don't waste time. And also expanding the flexible option degree program for working adults to earn their third degree. The UW system also is asking for an additional $19 million to be put into the Higher Education AIDS Board so that financial aid could be increased. Now, this would be the Wisconsin grant, which is money that Wisconsin students would not have to pay back. And that program has been flat since 2010. There hasn't been any additional money put into that beyond, I think it's $58.3 million. It's been that much since 2010, and there's so many more students who need that money.
We're talking right now about Governor Walker's proposed UW tuition cuts with Karen Herzog, higher education reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. And Karen, you mentioned money to the UW could be tied to measures like graduation rates, for instance. But another topic we've heard a bit about in recent days has been Republican legislators calling for intellectual diversity, and that would be AKA more conservative speakers, both professors and courses and that kind of thing on campus. Does that seem like it will get involved in this funding question?
You know, it's a really interesting question. How do you increase intellectual diversity on a campus? How do you legislate that? And how do you know, how would you measure whether a campus has been successful or not? I was talking with Assembly Speaker Robin Voss this morning, and we chatted a little bit about that because that's something that he's concerned about, and he would like to see that be something that UW system is really pushed to encourage and to ensure. But it's a very difficult thing to legislate. You know, a lot of the speakers that are brought to campus are brought by student groups. And while it's a topic that's really getting a lot of buzz, I'm not sure how it fits into the budget.
And Republicans in general have a lot of priorities this term. Do they seem to be on board with the governor's idea?
Well, it's too early to say how it is all going to shake out. Again, it depends on whether the state revenue forecasts are accurate, whether there's more money than expected, because as you point out, there's so many different budget priorities. Of course, the governor and legislators want to increase funding for K-12. And of course, then there's also Medicaid, and there's transportation, what to do about transportation and road funding. So there's so many competing priorities. It's still too early to know how it will all shake out.
And what about Democrats? What have Democrats had to say about this idea?
Well, I think Democrats are pleased to hear about, you know, efforts to improve affordability. Democrats last year were very focused on trying to help people who are, you know, already working refinance their college loans. Last year the big proposal was to create a new authority that would refinance student loans at lower interest rates. Now, that did not happen, and actually the any initiatives that have been out there on the end of you know, helping people with student loans haven't gone very far.
It sounds like there's also maybe concern that Governor Walker's idea could look a little bit like a baby step toward a Democratic idea, and that is free college.
Yes, and Robin Voss mentioned that he was really concerned about that, that he would rather see more money going into financial aid than, you know, giving money to people who perhaps don't need it. You know, there's obviously a certain percentage of the population that really could use the financial help, and that's when we're talking financial aid. And while there are others who can afford to pay what tuition is being charged, but it's all kind of complicated, and there are a couple of states that are looking at free tuition, variations on that depending on income in one case, and I believe that's in New York. Rhode Island also has a plan, but those are Democratic governors.
And in terms of what the university has said, have they stated a position yet? What do they think?
The university stays pretty neutral on these things. Of course, they will tell you, the university spokespeople will tell you that UW system really does want to make college affordable, that they're working to increase, advising, trying to improve time to graduation, making sure that students are getting what they need so that they can get out the door in 4 years. But it's all a very complicated scenario that has a lot of different factors involved. Students sometimes decide on their own that they want to spend more than 4 years in college. And, of course, that drives up the cost. If you think about one extra semester, that's another $5,000 added to the tuition bills that you have to pay off.
And, Karen, you said earlier, you talked about how this was popular with parents, with taxpayers, cuts like this to university tuition. But that hypothetical number you floated, 1%, was, not too high, $100, it sounded like, a year for these families. Is a number like that still enough to please voters?
Well, when it all boils down to it, it's kind of like, well, do you give people a tax break just because it's a tax break, whether it adds up to less than $100 or not? It's a political ideology of what do you think about cutting the costs for various things. And I think in the case of taxpayers, obviously, they want the cost of education to go down, and is a 1% or whatever the percentage increase, or excuse me, decrease would be enough? I think many would argue that it's more important to get them through faster rather than to give them, a $100 break, which is, maybe buys a couple of books.
We're talking about Governor Walker's proposed UW tuition cuts with Karen Herzog, higher education reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel.
And we'd like to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What do you think about the idea of tuition cuts at UW schools? Is this something that, even if you're in favor of, if you stack it up with other state priorities, is this something that you think should be a top priority in this budget? If you're a UW student or parent of a UW student, how would potential tuition cuts affect you? If you work in the UW system, what do you think about the current state of funding and what these tuition cuts could do? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We're picking up the conversation with Karen Herzog, a higher education reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, and we're taking a look at Governor Walker's proposed tuition cuts for UW undergraduate students.
You can share your thoughts now at 800-642-1234. Do you have a kid in a UW school? Would you like to see these tuition cuts, or maybe a kid on their way to a UW school? Do you support the idea of across-the-board tuition cuts, or would you rather see targeted need-based financial aid to more students in greater need in the state? Should lower tuition be a budget priority for Wisconsin? How about university system funding in general? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Let's take our first caller now. We've got Jesse with us in Milwaukee. Jesse, hi.
Hi. My question is, I have two small children, and I think the tuition cut is a good idea, even though it's only a small amount.
Mm-hmm. How come?
After the year-after-year inflation, it does add up to a big amount.
Okay, so is it symbolic for you, or is it more that you're saying it adds up?
I think it's both. It's symbolic, and it adds up. And if they cut it 1% now, maybe they cut 1% a year from now or 2 years from now, and rather than me paying $200,000 in 15 years to put my kids through 4 years at UW-Madison, maybe I'm only paying $100,000, and that makes a big difference.
Jesse, thanks a lot for that call. And Karen, Jesse saying, it adds up. It's not as insignificant. And this is a number that was put out there by the Legislative Fiscal Bureau. It's not a number that's being floated yet. But do you imagine the number would be in that ballpark? Is that a reasonable number to expect?
Well, it's an interesting point, and nobody really knows how much the governor was thinking about, but if you think about each percentage point being roughly $7 to $8 million, and that's based on what the university system had said for what they thought maybe they'd get a 1% increase in tuition the second year of the biennium, it's a good point that Jesse made about that it could be a cumulative effect if you have a 1% cut each year, but there's no guarantee it would be beyond 1 year and beyond this governor's term.
Jesse, thank you for the call. And we go next to Dick joining us in southern Dane County. Hi there.
Hi. My comment is, I think the crux of this is really going to be to see what is proposed. You know, if this is a very small cut, as in the last time we were promised a property tax cut, where I think it ended up being like $5 per property tax holder. Yes, everybody got a tax cut and everybody gets a tuition cut in this particular case, but is it really going to have a meaningful effect? So I think we really need to see whether what's being proposed here before we consider this to be a windfall for a win for families.
All right. Thank you for the comment, Dick. And Karen, he's saying wait and see. We don't really know enough yet.
I think he's absolutely right. I also think that it also depends on what else is in the mix. Is that 1% cut something instead of giving UW System more money beyond backfilling the tuition hole? What is it packaged with? I guess we'll wait and see.
And he was also getting at something else there, and this is, you know, the Governor Walker. Some people saying maybe looking at a third term as governor, is this the kind of move that a sitting governor would make if they were going to run again?
Well, if you think about the popularity of talking about, you know, free tuition or tuition cuts, that's something that catches people's attention. And if you're thinking about running for reelection, you want to be on the best side of voters, especially people who have kids who are going to be going to college anytime soon or who are currently in college.
We're talking with Karen Herzog right now from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, talking about proposed tuition cuts at the UW from Governor Walker in his State of the State address last week. We don't know the amount. We know it's proposed, and there seems to be some backing from both Republicans and Democrats, also hesitations on both sides. And we want to know what you think. At 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Do you support this? If this is a good thing for you and for your family's pocketbook, or are you concerned that maybe it's going to take your kid longer to graduate? Let us know. Maybe fewer course offerings. 800-642-1234 is the number. And we go to Camille in Eau Claire. Camille, hi.
Hi. I am a prospective college student right now, and frankly, I think a budget cut would do me personally a lot of good. I was forced to drop out of school when I did go to college, simply because I couldn't afford to go. I was looking at either becoming homeless and continuing my schooling, or keeping a roof over my head and dropping out. I'm still thousands of dollars in debt because of this decision, and I'm looking at either never being able to fully pay it off or taking a very, very long time to pay it off unless I go back to school. A budget cut would be great. I'm personally not a big fan of Scott Walker, never have been, but this is something that gives me a little bit of hope that something's being pushed in the right direction.
Camille, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate that. I'm sorry that you had to drop out and that you're struggling with debt. And Karen, I mean, that story is not unique. We've heard that from other people on the show and elsewhere. What do you think about the day-to-day effect of it on a student like Camille?
Well, unfortunately, Camille is got a lot of company that there are a lot of students who really struggle to stay in school because of, you know, the concern over borrowing too much money. And I get her point about just even a symbolic gesture of saying we're going to try to make it more affordable for you would be something that would give you hope. And that's certainly a really good point. However, there are a number of ways to make college more affordable that I think legislators will be looking at, and this is one of them. And I think it will be really interesting because voters really do care about this, and lawmakers have signaled that they really do want to make things better for UW System and for families who want to send their kids to college.
Karen, what are some of the other ways you think lawmakers will be looking at?
Well, again, if you look at the $42.5 million that the UW has requested, I don't have any idea how much they would get or how it would even be structured. But the thought behind that is there are very specific proposals about, you know, if you're increasing the amount of of credits that high school students can earn. Think about if you can start your college education in high school and get some of those core requirements out of the way. You know, putting programs into place that do that would save money if you could get through faster. And also advising is a big deal. If you're trying to figure out your major and you kind of don't have much direction, you're a first-generation college student, it's very difficult to make those decisions and to not make mistakes that can cost you more time. So that is part of it. I haven't heard anything about, you know, college loan debt so far this session. I think it's going to be mostly focused on how much should the UW system get and what should it be tied to, what measures, whether it's performance-based or whether it's ideas that can increase or decrease, rather, time to graduation.
Camille, thanks a lot for calling and for sharing your story. And another call now from Jim joining us in Rice Lake. Jim, hi.
I think that Walker's proposal for the small tuition discount is simply smoke and mirrors for him to cover up his $200 million cut to the University of Wisconsin system, not to mention his constant cuts to K-12 education, what I call his race to the bottom. And I think we shouldn't be surprised, because he is, I think, our Wisconsin's first governor who is a college, either a reject or a dropout. And I'll take your response off the air.
All right, Jim, thank you. And Karen, Jim's not having it. He doesn't think it's really a substantive call there. And he was also calling back to those budget cuts to the UW a while ago. And I wonder what you think that those cuts are going to do to the budget process this time. Is it going to be a pretty loaded process?
Well, I think there are a lot of people who feel that there should be some backfilling of money that has been cut in the past from the UW system. If you look at the bigger picture, state funding for the UW system has declined by $362 million from fiscal 2012 through fiscal 2017. And if you adjust that for inflation, GPR funding is now at the lowest level in UW system's history. So there are a lot of people who argue that you really need to be backfilling some of these cuts, and that, you know, anything that you do should not be symbolic. It should be actually giving the system money to get ahead rather than backfilling, you know, what you've taken away from them through a tuition cut. So there's so many different things, so many different ways of looking at it.
And Karen, just briefly as we wrap up, what do you expect to look for as the story goes forward?
I think it's going to be a really interesting session, and I think it's anybody's guess how this is all going to turn out. You know, the UW system in the past has been optimistic about getting additional funding, and early signals have been positive, but it just all depends on the overall revenue picture and other priorities.
Karen, thanks a lot for joining us.
You're welcome.
Karen Herzog there, a higher education reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. And we've been talking about the UW tuition cuts proposed by Governor Scott Walker at his State of the State address last week.